from Vermont Public. This is The Frequency. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. It's Friday, January 31st, and here are today's headlines. Republican Governor Phil Scott wants to impose new fees on the owners of electric vehicles. He says the growth in EV sales is putting a dent in revenues from the gas tax, which is one of the biggest sources of funding for the state's transportation fund. Scott says his administration will ask lawmakers this year to approve a new fee for EVs based on the number of miles they travel.
We're moving forward with the will of the legislature on this, and we think this is the fairest approach at this point.
The highest-ranking Democrat on the House Transportation Committee says lawmakers are open to supporting the plan. The concept has support from Vermont's environment community as well. Vermont's Attorney General Charity Clark says her office won't hesitate to challenge in court what she views as unlawful actions by the Trump administration. In the last week, Clark's office joined with a group of attorneys general around the country to block moves eliminating birthright citizenship and the freezing of federal grants and loans. Speaking at a statehouse press conference yesterday, Clark said she also believes federal authorities are now illegally apprehending people in Vermont without legal status. Clark said she's optimistic judges will overturn many of Trump's executive orders.
I am confident in the judicial system because I'm confident in America, and I'm confident that our democracy will withstand this kind of behavior by a president.
Since taking office, President Trump has also paused the National Refugee Resettlement Program and has frozen funds for groups that support refugees. For the better part of the last two decades, federal testing data consistently saw Vermont students outperforming their peers in other states in math and reading, but no longer. The latest results from the National Assessment of Educational Progress, released this week, show continued steady declines in reading scores for Vermont 4th and 8th grade students. And while Vermont students fared slightly better in math, scores still reflected a slide toward the national average in both subjects and both grades. Also known as the nation's report card, the data comes from tests administered by the federal government to a representative sample of students in all 50 states. What does it take to lead a good life? That's what Middlebury philosophy professor Lorraine Besser explores in her new book, The Art of the Interesting, What We Miss in Our Pursuit of the Good Life and How to Cultivate It. Yesterday on Vermont Edition, Besser said having interesting experiences is a crucial component of a life well lived, alongside finding happiness and meaning. She added that what someone may find interesting is unique to them.
So we should embrace that and really gives us a signal to kind of harness it within our lives, because we're not out searching for what is interesting. We should go about creating interesting experiences for ourselves.
You can listen to our full conversation with Besser through Vermont Edition's podcast feed or on our website, vermontpublic.org. And coming up, Vermont is not on track to build the number of homes the state needs by the end of the decade. Reporter Carly Berlin explores whether building more houses via assembly line could help pick up the pace. That's after this.
Thanks for listening to The Frequency, where support comes from VITA, supporting business growth and innovation in the Green Mountain State. From agriculture to manufacturing, energy to food production, find solutions that turn your business dreams into reality. Visit veda.org and see how VITA can help make it happen.
Last year, a little over 2,000 homes got built in Vermont. Any estimate you look at says we are not on track to build the number of homes the state needs by the end of the decade to close our huge housing gap. So how do we pick up the pace of construction? As Carly Berlin reports, some experts think we need to build more homes on the assembly line.
The company Huntington Homes builds about 70 houses a year, all inside this giant factory in East Montpelier.
The house starts on one end of the shop, and then it gets pushed down the assembly line.
This type of construction is called modular building. Huntington Homes co-owner Jason Webster likes to think of it as making a bunch of Lego blocks that eventually fit together into a house. First, workers frame the floors of each building block, then the walls, then the ceiling.
Then we do the mechanical rough-ins, insulation, sheetrock, taping, painting, finish work.
Your typical home builder would have to wrangle an electrician and a plumber and a roofer to a building site, which can give you lots of delays. But here, they're all working under one very large roof. Webster says that kind of streamlining means building a house can take a couple days instead of months.
So we can build a whole house in 12 8-hour shifts, so 96 hours.
That goes from that corner we're looking at.
From that corner all the way down to finished modules going out the door on the other end.
Then those Lego pieces get shipped out on a truck, a crane stacks them together, and voila. To the untrained eye, they look like any other house. Historically, Huntington Homes has mostly built single-family houses, a lot of them shipped out to clients in places like Nantucket. But recently, the company has started to branch out. Like right now, they're getting ready to build 45 duplexes and townhouses that'll be part of a big new mixed-income housing development in Middlebury. And Webster wants to do more. He isn't alone. Some housing wonks in Vermont are wondering if we should be building a lot more homes on the assembly line.
If we build one home at a time, a home here, a home there, then it's about the least efficient way that you can do anything, right? So do it one at a time.
Jeff Lubell is a housing researcher who lives in Norwich. He recently helped put together a state-commissioned report that looks at how to grow the off-site construction industry in Vermont. That's a catch-all term that includes manufactured housing, think single-wides and double-wides, and modular construction, like what Huntington Homes is doing. And Lubell says off-site building brings a lot of advantages. Like Webster said, you can build a home much faster. You can also build year-round through the winter. The labor itself is less physically demanding, which can open up the building trades to a bigger pool of potential workers. And Lubell says, if we do a lot of this, there's also the potential to bring down costs.
There's ways to start to imagine some what we call economies of scale, which are really where by doing multiple things at the same time, you have a lower cost per unit.
If you build a bunch of standardized homes at once, you can save on design costs. Maybe you can get a bulk deal on lumber or windows. In a typical development, Lubell says,
you might be able to build 2 units, 4 units, 10 units, even 20 units right on a particular site. But in a factory, you can build 100 units a year. You can build 200 units a year.
So how do we achieve that kind of scale in tiny little Vermont? Lubell's report has a few main recommendations. One is state government could make a bulk purchase of homes over a set amount of time to guarantee companies business. It could then pass those homes on to affordable housing agencies. Another is it could put public money toward getting more factories running, including a defunct manufactured home plant in the Rutland County town of Fairhaven.
It did both single wides and double wides. It employed probably at its peak, probably 150 people.
Bob Richards used to work at that Fairhaven factory back in the day, making sure all the trim and carpets were ready before the homes were shipped off. Now he chairs the town's select board. He says Fairhaven is doing a feasibility study right now to see if the plant still has the equipment it needs to start churning out houses again.
The whole idea of affordable housing, that's what that building was built for, and that's what it could do best. The town is absolutely in favor of that.
But here's the catch. This type of home building requires a lot of upfront investment, like to get a factory up and running. And that can mean it doesn't weather the booms and busts of the housing market too well. Any old home builder can just lay off some employees during an economic downturn, but a recession can doom a whole factory. That's what happened to the Fairhaven plant, which closed its doors a couple years after the housing bubble burst in 2008. And before then, New England had 8 full-scale modular factories, according to Webster. Now there are just 3, including the one in East Montpelier, which is still only producing about half as many houses per year as it did in 2007. All of this gives Housing Commissioner Alex Farrell some pause.
We, the state, need to be thinking about that eventual bust cycle. We're here to mitigate risk for the public and then for private developers, but we just don't want to leave the state holding the bag.
For now, though, the demand for homes in Vermont doesn't look like it's slowing down anytime soon. And to Lubell, the housing researcher, putting a relatively small amount of state funding toward more offsite construction is a low risk to the alternative, watching as home prices keep going up. For Vermont Public, I'm Carly Berlin.
That was Report for America Corps member Carly Berlin. Carly covers housing and infrastructure for VT Digger and Vermont Public. The late, great Tom Petty said it, or more accurately, sang it best, the waiting is the hardest part. And this week's sports report is focused on the waiting and the anticipation that comes with it. This is that weird time of year when the National Football League's AFC and NFC champions have already been crowned, but there's a week-long interim before the Super Bowl actually takes place. So we have to wait to find out whether the Kansas City Chiefs will become the first team in NFL history to three-peat as champs, or whether the NFC best Philadelphia Eagles can win it all for just the second time in their franchise history. It's tempting to reveal right now who I think will take the Vince Lombardi Trophy, but in keeping with today's theme, I'm going to wait until next week, just before the big game, to make my pick. In the meantime, here's a tip for those of you keen to wager on the outcome, and if you do, please do so within sane financial means. Just wait to hear who I think will win, and then bet the opposite. I still recall with a shudder of embarrassment telling anyone who would listen how the 1986 New England Patriots would upset the Chicago Bears that year. To be fair, the Pats kept it close, losing by only 36 points. I'm at least confident enough to say that this year's game will be a lot closer than that. We're also waiting for my favorite benchmark indicating that winter's icy grip doesn't hold on forever. That would be February 20th, when the first game of Major League Baseball's spring training takes place. Pitchers and catchers will report to the league's 30 teams even sooner, not long after the calendar mercifully sheds us of January's 31-day tenure. Any month that has more days in it than there are baseball teams seems too long to me. But Boston Red Sox fans are also waiting to see if the team will sign a still-missing and much-needed right-handed power hitter for 2025. Longtime Houston Astros third baseman Alex Bregman has reportedly been on Boston's radar for a while now, and maybe by the time you're hearing this, or later today, he'll be headed to Fenway. The 30-year-old Bregman may be slightly past his prime, but not so much that he still wouldn't be a very good pickup, especially after losing Tyler O'Neill to the Baltimore Orioles in free agency. O'Neill managed 31 homers for Boston last year, even though he missed a lot of games due to injury, so his production needs to be replaced. I'd have preferred Teoscar Hernandez, but he decided to re-up with the world champion LA Dodgers, a team that appears to be trolling the rest of the league as it stocks up yet again with star power, or at least players with the potential for it. That includes phenom pitcher Roki Sasaki, who's technically coming over from Japan as a rookie in Major League Baseball, and joins a squad already boasting the best player on Earth, who's also from Japan, Shohei Ohtani. And they have so much additional talent that they really have overtaken the New York Yankees as the team everyone but Dodgers fans love to hate. I'm done with Dodger dominance myself, unless they face the Yankees in the World Series again, in which case, yay, yay, go LA. We Red Sox fans are nothing if not pettily devoted to always rooting against the Yankees to win it all. Hockey-wise, it's a different kind of waiting for Boston Bruins fans, waiting for the team to either turn around their middling, maddening ways of playing just barely well enough to stay on the edges of the playoff bubble, or to just tank it already and put us out of our misery. Color me beyond surprised if they were able to score a win against the best in the West, Winnipeg Jets, last night, but even if they did, it doesn't change the fact that they had a chance to separate from teams jam-packed like sardines into the wildcard chase against the worst in the Eastern Conference Buffalo Sabres earlier this week and instead got blown out in a 7-2 loss. It's games like that that make you want to take Bobby Orr's name in vain, and there have been far too many of them for the baffling Bruins this season. We'll know better whether these Bees have a realistic shot at the playoffs once the league pauses for its Four Nations tournament on February 12th, and more on that intriguing replacement for the annual All-Star break next week. The Boston Celtics have been up and down over the past couple of weeks, suffering a blowout loss to the rival LA Lakers and falling at home to the Houston Rockets, but they also scored wins against the team they beat in the finals last year, the Dallas Mavericks, and the Chicago Bulls. I'm convinced the Celtics are saving their best for the postseason, and I've still got them penciled in for a title repeat, but we'll just have to wait and see. Thanks for listening to The Frequency today. We had additional reporting from Peter Hirschfeld, Bob Kinzel, Lola Dufour, and Daniela Fierro. Our executive producer is Kevin Trevelyan, and our music is by Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Talk to you Monday.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.